You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Mitch Daniels is about to drag Indiana down the rabbit hole of right to work for less. The war on labor continues. The war on working people continues. And probably like Scott Walker, he's got a few millionaires and billionaires funding his campaign and his whole shtick. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting all around the planet. And Taft-Hartley, this, you know, what's going on in Indiana, number one, should be a major national news headline. This was back in the 40s when this was decriminalized, what Mitch Daniels is doing, which would have been against the law in 1946. But it got decriminalized by a Republican Congress in 1947. Now, keep in mind that, you know, the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate from 32, you know, the election of FDR, right up to 46. And 46, it was after the war, and Roosevelt was dead, and Truman wasn't all that popular, and he was, you know, and basically people, you know, a new generation had come up, and a lot of people had come back from the war and said, okay, let's try the other party. You know, they've been itching for a chance for a long time. So the Republicans took both the House and Senate for 2 years, and they did an incredible amount of damage. And the main damage they did was this thing called the Taft-Hartley Act. And, I mean, it was so much damage, and Truman went after them so vigorously that they lost the House in the election of 48 and didn't get it again for nearly 30 years. In fact, I think it was 46 years later that they got it. But whatever it was a long time. It was another generation before the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives. But here's what... First of all, let's start in 1936, when Franklin Roosevelt says, I'm going to make sure that people have the right to unionize, to collectively bargain, to have a living wage. And by the way, given Newt Gingrich's love for child labor, you're going to find a nice little one in here, too. Anyhow, here's Franklin Roosevelt in 1936.
Of course we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. To reduce hours that are overlong. To increase wages that spell starvation. To end the labor of children and to wipe out sweatshops. Of course, we will continue every effort to end monopoly in business, to support collective bargaining. To stop unfair competition and to abolish dishonorable trade practices. And for all these, we have only just begun to fight.
We have only just begun to fight. And he was serious. I mean, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was serious. So that was 36. That got undone in 1947. And on June 20th, 1947, Harry Truman, you know, this Taft-Hartley labor bill, what it said basically... They got passed by the Republican House and Senate. Truman vetoed it, sent the veto back to the House and Senate. And they overrode his veto. So it's still law. Has been ever since 47. I think it should be repealed right now. In fact, Ronald Reagan called for its repeal. We'll get to that in just a second at one point in his political life. But in his veto, statement, Harry Truman said, you know, the real meaning of this bill is startling. It would reverse the basic direction of our national labor policy. It would inject the government into private economic affairs on an unprecedented scale. It would conflict with important principles of our democratic society. It would contribute neither to industrial peace nor to economic stability and progress. It would be a dangerous stride in the direction of a totally managed economy. It contains seeds of discord which would plague this nation for years to come. And it has. 22 states now have said we're going to become right-to-work-for-less states. And what happens in those states, in the right-to-work-for-less states, in the 22 right-to-work-for-less states? Average wages are $5,333 a year less in the right-to-work-for-less states, which Indiana is about to become one of. Wages drop by over $5,000. 21% of the people in those states lack health insurance that is held by people in unionized states, in what are called free bargaining states. Poverty is 2.3% higher in the right-to-work-for-less states. I wonder why. And workplace deaths and injuries, 51% higher. I mean, this is how bad it gets. Here's Ronald Reagan calling this out in an ad for Harry Truman.
This is Ronald Reagan speaking to you from Hollywood. You know me as a motion picture actor. But tonight I'm just a citizen, pretty concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, and I quote, "We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions," unquote. Remember that promise, a real increase in income for everybody. But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946, but what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost a million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States. Democratic faces.
There you go.
This is why we must...
Democrat, and then he goes on to pitch for Hubert Humphrey. But... Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley Act. That was Ronald Reagan. In 1940, what year was that? That would have, must have been 48. It must have been the election of 40s. Yeah, that was the election of 48. And speaking as a Democrat. And now Mitch Daniels is about to do it in Indiana. More on this when we come back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what did Harry Truman have to say about this? And by the way, Mitt Romney's wife? Oh, it's unfortunate we had to release our taxes.
Well, I was born on a Sunday. Well, Thursday I had me a job.
So here we have Indiana on the edge. And take this very seriously. You know, speaking to our listeners in Indiana who are listening on Sirius or XM or on the web or... there are no progressive radio stations in the state, to best of my knowledge. or who are watching on Free Speech TV on Dish Network or on DirecTV or on one of our affiliated TV stations there, particularly to those of you in Indiana. Take this very seriously. What this guy, what Mitch Daniels, what George W. Bush's former, you know, head economic advisor, what he's about to do to your state is to devastate it. And at this point, I mean, you know, he's probably going to sign the bill next week. Apparently the Senate and House bill have slight differences. They need to be reconciled in conference committee. That's not going to take very long. These Republicans are just gung-ho. They are going to move on this thing. They are going to take advantage of Taft-Hartley. Taft-Hartley should be repealed. And you know, having 22 right-to-work-for-less states competing with the balance of the states in the union that are in our union, in the United States, that are free bargaining states, is nuts. It's like we've carved out, you know, these cheap labor zones to say, okay, here, you know, here, no unions here. We're going to drive down our standard of living here. This is what he's about to do. This is what Harry Truman had to say about this in his 1948 State of the Union, referring to the Taft-Hartley Act that Mitch Daniels is using in Indiana to try to destroy labor.
The working men and women of the nation are unfairly discriminated against by a statute that abridges their rights, curtails their constructive efforts, and hampers our system of free collective bargaining. That statute is the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, sometimes called the Taft-Hartley Act. That act should be repealed.
There you go. That act should be repealed. I mean, it's that simple. And what this says, let me just explain how this works. Right now, democracy in a workplace is a union. There is no democracy in a normal workplace. A normal workplace is a kingdom. Right? The owner of the company or the owners of the company or the CEOs of the company or what the management of the company has basically king-like powers. And with a union in the workplace, you have the workers getting together and having some say in how their workplace operates or functions. And in workplaces that are particularly subject to abuse, industrial workplaces, places where people can get their fingers chopped off by machines, you know, workplaces where there's a long history of you know, paying people badly and treating people badly, there's a real need for unions, for democracy in the workplace, for an opportunity to push back. Now, the way it works in most of the states in the union, in the majority of states in the United States, is that, you know, if there's 100 employees in the company and 51 of them vote for a union, you know, 51% a majority, then you get a union. And the union then functions under a set of rules that are established by a majority vote. What do we want to have our bylaws be? What do we want to set our dues at? Who are we going to elect to represent us in bargaining with the employer? Who are we going to, you know, elect to represent us to you know, in other venues? All that kind of stuff. It's all democratically decided. And because there's now a union in the workplace, and everybody who works in that workplace benefits from that union, everybody who is in that workplace has a small portion of their income, you could call it taxed, it's union dues, it's taken out of their paycheck every week or every month or, you know, however often they get paid, and goes to the union to support the existence of the union. And the benefits that people get out of being in a union shop outweigh the cost of the union shop. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. And that's why unions came into being, and that's why there are still unions, and particularly in the free bargaining states. Now, what right to work legislation, so-called right to work, I call it right to work for less legislation, does is it says, okay, 51% of the people want a union. Fine, you got a union, but if you don't want to pay the union dues, you don't have to. So what happens is that a lot of people and you know, a lot of people will just say, you know, I don't want to pay the union dues. I don't want to be part of this union, even though I get all the benefits of them. And that then creates a situation in the workplace where you've got two people working next to each other. One's paying union dues and knows that they're paying, you know, to carry the load, and the other person's paying nothing. which of course jacks up the union dues for the person who's paying. And now you got these guys looking at each other like we're on two sides of the fence here. It right to work for less creates discord in the workplace. Discord in the workplace. That's a quote, by the way, from Harry Truman's veto statement. It also means that the union now has less money to function because everybody's not paying into it, and so it's harder for them to do their job. The people who aren't paying are less likely to participate in the union, to vote in the union elections and things. They don't feel like it's their democracy. So the so-called right to work for less legislation that came out of Taft-Hartley, what the inevitable result is that unions are destroyed. And when Taft-Hartley was passed, we had 35% of workers in the United States unionized in 1947. 35%. When Reagan came into office, it was down to 25%. It had dropped 10% in the 20 or so years from 47 to 80. Yeah, more or less. It had dropped 10% just in that period of time. From the time Reagan came into office and openly declared war on labor by busting PATCO, we're down to 7-8% of the private workforce, 11% if you include all the government employees, are unionized in the United States. And this is because of Taft-Hartley. We need to repeal Taft-Hartley. And somebody needs to come up with a plan to stop Mitch Daniels in Indiana from signing another right to work for less law.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is plain old, flat-out nuts, what's going on in Indiana, and it needs to be stopped because it's destroying the American middle class, which, of course, is their goal.
There's power in the factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. It all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. Power in a union.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. Mitch Daniels in Indiana, I think it's emblematic of what's going on across the entire United States. You've got Republicans trying to drive a race to the bottom. They say, oh, look at these government employees. They're making $40,000, $50,000 a year. Isn't that a terrible thing? Wait a minute. That used to be, when Reagan came into office, government employees made less than people in the private sector. Now it's the other way around. Why is that? Because government employees have a union that hasn't been busted, although they're trying. They're trying to take out the post office. It's the largest union in the country, the Postal Service Employees Union, 500,000 members. Do you get what's going on? This is the race to the bottom, and Mitch Daniels is putting it on steroids in Indiana, in your state, Shirley. Hey, Shirley, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV in Indianapolis, Indiana. What's up?
What's up? I'm just pulling my hair out at Mitch Daniels. He's been trying to do this since day one when he took office in 05.
Mm-hmm.
His first attack was he went after AFSCME. Those are the county and municipal workers.
Employees union, yeah.
Yes. He terminated all their union contracts. That covered over 20,000 employees. He terminated. And that was something else that was wrong because one person shouldn't have the right, shouldn't be able to terminate over 20,000 workers' contracts.
Right, and if it hadn't been for Taft-Hartley, he wouldn't have had that right, by the way.
Yeah, I know, and then he did that, and other unions in the state, like the private sector unions, like they really didn't come to AFSCME's defense because they thought they could cut some type of deal with Mitch Daniels while people were saying, hey, he's coming for us first, he's coming for you next, and he has done that.
Yep.
It drives me crazy, and especially like here in the Midwest, like you said, the Midwestern states were a free collective bargaining states.
Yes.
They're trying to turn us into the South.
I know.
I don't want to be in the South.
And the Midwest is where it all began. I mean, the first unions in Wisconsin and Michigan and the industrial heartland of America. I grew up in Michigan. My dad worked in a union shop all his life. Two of my three brothers were shop stewards in their unions,
right,
in the printers union and the electricians union. I'm real familiar with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a member of a union myself right now. Radio and television. But in any case, the point is that what Mitch Daniels is doing is he is leading the thing that blows my mind is that this is not a national story.
No.
That
and
this guy.
It makes me so mad, except for you and MSNBC.
Yeah.
And that's only with some of the hosts.
Yeah.
This is an outrage.
No, I'm with you, Shirley. It is absolutely an outrage. Thank you very much for calling in from Indianapolis. I do appreciate it. Great to hear from you. This is incredible. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for educating us about the Taft-Hartley Act. I knew a little bit about it, and I know a lot more now, but that is the whole problem, is that at every level in this country, in schools, people should know about the Taft-Hartley Act. It should be started, you know, as soon as you start teaching history.
Yep.
Labor history is left out. Like in Arizona, they want to leave out 300 years of Hispanic history.
Yep.
So, you know, that is the problem, is that there is actually a conspiracy against labor. I felt this for the longest time. I come from a union family also. You know, my mother's relatives fought the fight in the garment workers union. And, you know, they're just, it's just incredible that people want to return this country backward, you know, back to that. I mean, every other country that's developing is actually improving the situation of their workers, and unions are having more power, like, say, in Brazil. But anyway, my point is that there is a conspiracy of silence about labor. McAllister College has an excellent labor program. I went to see William Grider speak at it. I've talked to the head of the department there, and he, even on, quote, liberal public Minnesota public radio, which is the largest public radio system in that system, has yet to ask this person who is head of the labor department in one of the most prominent colleges here on their show to do a program about labor. How about that? Isn't that interesting that we hear nothing about Taft-Hartley, we hear nothing about Eugene Debs. How many people know anything about labor history?
Right, or, you know, we did a show on the anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, you know, and this is a couple of months ago, and I most people don't have any recollection of that. I mean, you know, which is the thing that led to many of these labor laws, and also the workplace safety laws. Here, you mentioned your mother was a member of the Lady Garment Workers Union, right?
Well, actually, the ILG. My grandmother.
Let me give you a flash from the past, if I may. I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but that's a union that pretty much no longer exists because we don't make ladies' garments in the United States anymore. But this was a TV ad that ran in the 1970s. Let me just play this for you, if I may.
There used to be more of us in the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, but a lot of our jobs have disappeared.
This is 1978.
A lot of the clothes Americans are buying for women and kids are imports. They're being made in foreign places. When the work's done here, we can support our families and pay our taxes and buy the things other Americans make. That's what it means when the label says union.
Look for the union label when you are buying one coat, dress, or gloves. Remember somewhere our union's sewing, our wages going to feed the kids and run the house.
Our wages going to feed the kids. Anyway, this is look for the union label, right? You remember that, John?
Absolutely.
That was 1978.
I also remember hearing the stories in my family about people in sweatshops and how they would be pulled away from the sewing machine because they had fallen asleep, and they'd dump you on the floor, and there would be somebody behind you to take that position because they were never given breaks.
Yep.
They worked like...
No, you're absolutely right, John. And these were the sweatshops that in that Reagan clip earlier, 1948, Ronald Reagan was decrying. I find it so ironic, by the way, that once he became a Republican, he started doing all the things that he had been condemning. Anyhow, John, thank you for the call. And Sally in Detroit. Hey, Sally, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm astounded. This Taft-Hartley Act... it has been on the books since before most of us were born.
Yep.
And my point to your screener was, with all of the money that the unions garner, and whether it's a lot or a little or whatever, I've never had the privilege, believe me. Well, Myra Wolfgang, the Hotel Motel Restaurant Employees Union in Detroit, I did work there once. But since then, I've been a small business owner, went through, I won't go through the whole resume, but the point is I wasn't fortunate enough to have union protection and support in any of my jobs. But if any of these guys, Bob King from the UAW, all of these skilled trade unions, take 1% of the dues, allocate it, make this a national awareness program, make it a national awareness program, not the union, a couple of commercials here in the Midwest, over here, Mitch Daniels, No, it has to be national awareness, because believe me, I've been in this workforce long enough to know the tacit message that has been going out for years about when you do prepare to go into the workplace, prepare yourself not to belong to a union.
Yeah, no, and because 93% of the private workforce right now is not unionized. You're absolutely right, Sally. Thank you for the call and for pointing that out. I had, we did a Conversations with Great Minds, a 30-minute segment. It's over at our website, conversationswithgreatminds.com, with Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO. And I said, you know, don't we need to repeal Taft-Hartley? And he's like, absolutely. But, you know, that is one huge thing to do. And I think the unions have been so weakened by you know, all these years of Taft-Hartley, a half a century of Taft-Hartley, that they don't have the power to do it anymore. But we may have that. We have to wake people up to this. Steve in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
I've been listening to you for about the last 2 days. I hear you're from Michigan.
I grew up in Lansing.
I am from Lansing. I'm actually a GM retiree, 30 years. I've been retired for about 4 years, 2008, just about the time everything started going down bad.
Yep.
Well, here's some things I haven't been hearing is that what's happening in Wisconsin and what's happening in Indiana. And late last night, I thought I heard that Mitch Daniels signed it. Okay, and I haven't heard any more on it. But Michigan is going through the same thing.
Oh, even worse. You've got a governor who's saying that he can kick out elected officials.
There's a lot of things pertaining to the unemployment. We're down to only 20 weeks. I don't know where the 99 comes into play yet. I haven't figured that one out.
Yep.
Let's see, he's got a bridge that he's trying to get built. He just now taxed the retirees.
Yep.
And
he's taking money from working people and poor people, and he's giving tax breaks to multinational corporations. And the Democrats are saying, you know, he gave a $1.8 billion tax cut to the corporations. Let's take that money back. That's enough for every college student who's going to a state college or a state junior college in the state of Michigan to go to college for free. Let's do that. Let's build our intellectual infrastructure. And the Democrats are being laughed at by the Republicans. And in the meantime, your governor, Rick Snyder, your governor as I said, I was born in Michigan. I was born in Grand Rapids. I lived there the first 27 years of my life. And it's just, and all my family is still there. It is just horrifying to see what's happening to your state, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. What can we do? Well, it's got to be movement politics. And if you can't join a union, you can still speak up. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Darren in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Hey, Darren, what's on your mind today?
Hey, buddy. Thanks for taking my call. I would just like to say to your listeners, look around at your country and your country. And this is what the two-party politics system has done to it. It has destroyed it systematically. You know, I'm listening to you talk about
it. I disagree.
I would
submit that it is money and politics that has done this, not the two-party system.
Absolutely. And that is, and the two-party system is now beholden to it because of the banksters.
No, because of the Supreme Court. Study your history.
I have. And the banksters have come in and they've taken over our money policy.
Yes.
They print the money. and they're making the rules, and they can print as much money as they want.
Oh, you're talking about the Fed?
Bribing everybody. Yes,
The Fed is not, you know, yeah, I'm not a fan of the Fed. I think the Fed should be nationalized. It should be taken out of the Treasury Department or abolished. I'm with Ron Paul on all that. But the Fed is not what is corrupting our political system. The Fed, you could argue, is corrupting our monetary system, and it's why the dollar has decreased in value so much since 1913. Although the dollar was decreasing in value before that, by the way. But the bottom line is that what has given the ability of billionaires and multimillionaires to buy politicians, for Shelley Adelson to give $10 million to Newt Gingrich to keep him in the race, you know, for the one single topic that Shelley really cares about. You know, what has done that is the Supreme Court. A series of Supreme Court decisions starting in 1886 with Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, going to in the 1970s, Buckley versus Vallejo in the 1980s, First National Bank versus Bilotti, and in 2010, Citizens United. These decisions handed our politicians over to the tender mercies of billionaires, millionaires, and large transnational corporations. And frankly, I'll tell you, Republicans as well as Democrats, when you talk to them privately in person and you say, do you like the fact that you have to spend anywhere from 30 to 70% of your entire workday, not at the Capitol building, but in some little rental office around the Capitol building here in Washington, D.C., dialing for dollars? Because, you know, if you don't do that, that every morning you wake up, you know that you have to raise $10,000 to $20,000 and you won't be reelected. Do you like that? All of them. I've never had one of them say, yes, I like that. Never. I mean, there might, you know, Duke Cunningham had his little bribery list, right? You know, for this kind of legislation, I'll take these many dollars. And he's in prison for that. I mean, there might have been a few who thought that they could game the system. But I'm telling you, right across the board, the politicians hate it. They would love to see an end to this. It's just that they're afraid to stand up and speak out because the money is so big it will squash them like a bug. And so the only politicians who can stand up and speak out about this are people like Bernie Sanders, who's actually calling for a constitutional amendment to say to the Supreme Court, okay, you know, we're going to stick it to you guys, the Supreme Court, because we're going to put it in the Constitution, and you can't pretend that you know, money is speech and the corporations are people is in the Constitution, because we're going to put in the Constitution the fact that it's not. And Bernie can do that because he represents a state of 600,000 people, and he's been representing that state for almost 20 years, and he's probably had an opportunity to shake the hand of every single person in that state at least twice. I know I lived there a decade, and I went to three different Bernie events, just kind of stumbled across them. I mean, he's in his state every single weekend. Most politicians don't have the luxury of being able to run like that, and that's the problem, Darren. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, but that's, you know, that's the bottom line. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind today?
You know, I'll tell you, I think the reason that they're trying to do this whole thing with labor is because they're trying to dumb us down.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If we have no money, we can't fight back.
Well, this was the point that in the 1950s, Russell Kirk was making. In the early 1960s, William F. Buckley was making. Barry Goldwater was making. All these guys on the conservative right, built the original Bill Kristol, you know, William Kristol's dad, was making. The early neocons, Leo Strauss was making, who was Paul Wolfowitz's teacher. What these guys were saying in the 1950s was that this legislation, that, you know, the National Labor Relations Act, the right to unionize, the national industrial policy and tariffs, these things that were put into place and maintained by people like Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower as well, by the way. They didn't like him either. That what these things did was they would create a strong middle class. And if you have a strong middle class where kids can go to college relatively inexpensively, where, like, my wife who worked her way through college working as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's, I mean, you know, my mother who worked her way through Michigan State University working summers as a lifeguard in Charlevoix, Michigan. I mean, you could do that for a long time. If that middle class got big enough, those people would start getting uppity. And that's what happened in the 60s, and that's when they said, okay, we got to take down the middle class.
You know, I saw that thing about the Triangle Shirt Factory.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I saw the anniversary, and that was so sad, man.
Yeah.
I cried.
Yeah.
I literally cried.
Oh, I mean, it was over 100 women who were, I think it was 120,
so
23 women who were locked in and burned to death. They were jumping out of seventh floor windows.
It was so sad.
Yeah. It was that generation's 9/11. And it produced that, and it brought about these workplace safety laws, and it's moved the stimulated the move to unionize. Walter, thanks for the call. Thanks for your kind comments. Jim in Claremont, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Jim, minute to the end of the show. What's up? Or this hour.
There's a saying in economics, capital flows to cheap labor. And when they get the opportunity to do that, you know these darn carpetists are going to do it.
Yep.
Now, you've mentioned many times about the link between our trade policies and our work situation,
yes,
labor situation. And the most effective thing I can see now is we've got to start excluding certain items and putting heavy tariffs. I mean, Tom, there's fair trade and there's free trade. And this gentleman from England said one time, he was one of the higher ups there, he said, the surest route for financial disaster is for first world countries to engage in a labor battle with third world countries.
Yeah.
And he was exactly
right. That was Sir James
right.
Goldsmith.
That's exactly who it was.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, he wrote an amazing book called The Trap. And he was, at that time, he was one of the three richest men in the world. And he was a good progressive and a brilliant man. Spot on, Jim. Well said. Thank you very much. Up next, is the Tea Party dead, kaput, nada? Or did they just become the 1%? Let's ask a Tea Partier. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, here's an interesting statistic for you. The average net worth, the median net worth of a member of the House of Representatives is $755,000. All right, right across the board, regardless of party, $755,000. However, the average net worth of members of the House Tea Party Caucus, $1.8 million. Has the Tea Party become the 1%? Kevin Jackson is the founder of the Black Sphere. He is the author of, where did it go here? Oh, author of The Big Black Lie. That's interesting. And a media advocate for the Tea Party, theteaparty.net, the website. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
What is Black Sphere, by the way?
Oh, the Black Sphere. It wasn't racial in any intent. It was just sort of the idea of a black hole, and if you had a thought that could get out, it had to be powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the sphere, of course, being the most voluminous thing in nature. So it was a crazy engineering mind of mine that came up with the idea.
Okay. So is the Tea Party dying out?
Absolutely not.
Why aren't we seeing Tea Party activities all over?
What's that?
Why aren't we seeing Tea Party activities all over anymore?
Well, you know, that's the beauty of it, is people are still doing last year's analysis of what should be happening. If there's not a rally or some big march, then all of a sudden, you know, things are not happening. The things that the Tea Party is doing behind the scenes are absolutely going to blow people's mind. And what's interesting to me is the Tea Party is constantly being discussed. People on the left are talking about the Tea Party's influence here. You can't have a day in Congress where Tea Party doesn't come up, but we're always talking about the death of the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, well, if you guys, that's fine. I'll take your word for it that you're stronger than ever. I know that, you know, the Koch brothers have billions. The Dick Armey is a multimillionaire.
Oh, sure.
You guys are promoting
that's who sets the stage for the Tea Party is a couple of billionaires.
Well, they put a lot of money into
George
it.
George Soros would set the stage for the left. I wouldn't say George Soros runs the left. You know, the Koch brothers have a lot of money, and they do what they want with it. So does George Soros. So does Warren Buffett. So does Bill Gates. There are lots of people on the left whose fortunes dwarf anybody's on the right. I would love to trade the Bill Gates.
Bill Gates is not
a
brothers. Bill Gates has been vaccinating kids in Africa. I mean,
Bill Gates has been talking about destruction of human beings by saying let's limit the population and things like this. So, look, if we're going to get into these philosophical battles of who's worse on the left or the right, nothing gets accomplished.
No, my question is, you know, if you're saying the Tea Party is alive and well, it probably is. I mean, I'm looking at the net worth of the Tea Party caucus. You know, you elected a bunch of millionaires to Congress, And none of them, for example, believe in global warming, things like that. So I get it. You know, you've got a lot of political power.
I can look at Nancy Pelosi, who in 2008 was worth $12 million.
I'm not picking on you. Stop for a minute. What is this incredible stuff that's going on in the background that you alluded to?
No, what I'm telling you is that if you want to look at people in their right perspective, because you could take one person out of Congress, you could take Issa, who's worth $300 million, and you could buy a lot of people in Congress for his money. So trying to make it...
He's a Republican.
This Tea Party is worth $1.8, they're worth $700,000. All those people are in the 1%. So what are we talking about? I'm talking about President Obama in the State of the Union literally telling America that Congress has the ability to inside trade, and we're going to stop that. But if you and I inside traded right now, we would go to prison.
Right.
Now, I don't care. That has no politics. That's all of Congress. And I can give you an example.
Oh, I know. This is something that
$12 million, who's now worth $35 million in the worst economic period of America. But you want to talk about what's the worth of the average Tea Party person. That's completely disingenuous.
Kevin, let me ask you this question. You said that the Tea Party has plans for the future. Now, I see on your website that, you know, you're in favor of free markets, for example. So you must like the fact that there's 800,000 jobs making Apple products that are outside the United States in low wage places rather than being here in the United States. That's a good thing in your mind?
No, what's a good thing in my mind is when we can do things that are proactive in bringing business back to the United States. If you want to look at
what
the
would
things
you do?
That kill jobs, it's erroneous, it's egregious legislation, overbearing government, union prices that have run these businesses offshore. Steve Jobs is one of the most liberal people when he was alive. He was one of the most liberal people in the world. And even he knew he couldn't make his product in America for a profit.
He could have made his product. He could. Steve, I'm sorry, Kevin. That's not factual. He knew that he could have made his product in the United States for a profit, just not that big a profit. Apple just announced a profit that was about a quarter of all the money ran through Apple. They're distributing as profit, or they're declaring as profit. That's incredible. Now, if they made those things in the United States instead of having a $12 or $15 billion profit. But again, to your question, do you think that it's a good thing that after 200 years of our having a national trade policy and a national industrial policy that built a strong middle class and a huge manufacturing base in this country, we've had 30 years of Reaganomics that has destroyed that and all this free trade insanity? Do you think you're actually buying into this free trade stuff that only helps the big transnational corporations and people like lobbyists like Dick Armey who runs FreedomWorks?
Oh, yeah. So you would love for me to say that I'm buying into something. What I'm buying into is the idea that if you enact the right policies in the United States, you'll keep business here. But you know what the shame of it
is? So you're saying big government can make business work.
That you guys don't want to look at the world as a global marketplace, that there people are going to compete and countries are not going to be fair about it, and you've got to make those adjustments. So let's look at the unions and how much they charge for the same products and services, and the idea that we have people retiring and making more money in retirement than they do when they work.
So Kevin, you're upset about the fact that American workers make too much money.
No.
That's what you just said.
No, I'm not.
You just went off on, you know, union labor. Look at how expensive it is. It's driving people offshore. It's driving people offshore. It's you know, we can't handle it. You know, it's union labor. Quack, quack, quack. You just want us to be like, what? Pick a country. What labor rate should we have?
Should be, and that's what unions do. If the fair market value of a product is based
on did you like not stop talking? You didn't take a breath.
To do that, I don't care if people make money. I'm a capitalist.
Okay. Did you hear anything I said, Kevin, or were you trying to filibuster me through that whole thing?
You said, because I've learned that when it comes to the liberal media, I don't really pay that much attention to you guys. You don't make any sense.
Okay, Kevin. Thank you very much. I'm going to put Kevin on hold. Well, what the hell? I'm not going to. I'll let you back in here, Kevin. Let me ask you again. What is it that the Tea Party is going to be doing that you're so excited about?
I'm excited because the Tea Party has launched youth and diversity initiatives, things that take the voice that's been just an echo chamber of ignorance And they're going to be changing the direction of that. They're going to be changing things like telling blacks, you know what, we're going to really work to get you better schools. We're not going to just let you be a product of the indoctrination system that the government has put people through. We're going to use fiscal, the same fiscal responsibility.
So this all-white Tea Party is going to be the champion of African-American civil rights?
We already have been.
Then why is it the most African-Americans aren't joining you?
Well, I would tell you, if you look at the polling, you're starting to see a little bit of a thing that would scare the left. Just recently, Obama is now at only a 79% approval rating with blacks, dropping from 87. Same thing with independents. And see, what it is about this is you guys seem to believe that you need to help us. The left is always telling blacks, we've got to help you. We're not as helpless as you think.
I haven't heard Kevin, you're hallucinating.
You're not helping us.
You're making things up.
Oh,
You guys
so
keep creating these straw men,
like,
oh, it's the labor unions that are destroying America. It's not the labor unions. It's the insanity of the free trade laws. It's you're saying, liberals are saying we've got to help you. No, well, all you got to do is stop people from. Stop racism. Stop institutional racism.
Well, let's stop racism because you need to stop helping black people. You're not helping us.
Okay. Are you a black person, Kevin?
Yes, I happen to be.
Okay. All right. Well, in that case,
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I will let you stand on that statement then. Kevin, the teaparty.net is the website. Kevin John Jackson. Thank you, Kevin.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology.
Okay, you know what the anterior cingulate cortex, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, cingulate I think it is, cortex is? It's a part of the brain that is overactive in depression. This is our geeky science moment, my minute or two in the entire week when I can talk about science instead of politics, because I love science, science geek myself here. That area of the brain is overactive in depression, and they have discovered a drug that affects that area of the brain in a way that it appears to cure depression. Now, this is a part of the brain that they've been trying to cure depression by literally drilling holes through the skull, putting a little electrode in and stimulating electrically. But this drug is called psilocybin. It's the magic mushrooms. Cures depression. It's also useful in terminally ill cancer patients dealing with anxiety. Really quite remarkable. Among healthy volunteers, they found that people have long-lasting positive effects from the vivid memories of being on psilocybin in a controlled experimental setting. People report mystical experiences of feeling the interconnectedness of all things, which can be life-changing. This is a verbatim quote from the article, the CNN report on this. One of the researchers said, people claim to have an enhanced sense of self, more emotional balance, they're more compassionate, they're more sensitive to the needs of others, they have more well-being, less depression, but they're not high in any conventional sense. They feel like their perceptual set has shifted. And then they say that the positive outcomes that users attribute to this can last as long as 25 years. So, therefore, I'm overdue. Anyway, back to politics. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Steve in Warwick, Mass. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Yes, Thomas. This is in response to that Mr. Jackson you just had on.
Yeah.
All right, we've always had free trade. All our corporations and businesses were always free to trade elsewhere and stuff, as well as here and stuff that was made by Americans. Yes, but they sacrificed their the well-being of their fellow citizens for profit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one thing that isn't being talked about.
And that's, I agree with you. And that's something that Apple did. That's something that a lot of other companies did. But the fact of the matter is that they did it perfectly legally, and they did it in a way that you could argue they're obligated to. They have, the Dodge versus Ford Michigan Supreme Court case back in the 30s. A corporation is required to return maximum profit to its shareholders. Now, this is something that should be changed at law. We should have, and some states are now allowing B corporations, benefit corporations, where the principal purpose of the corporation is not to make a profit but to benefit the community. through manufacturing, through making things, but not so much, you know, the making of profits. But, you know, this is a direction, Steve, thank you very much. It's a direction that we need to go. I'm with you. I'm totally with you on this. Darlene in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Darlene, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want a little change of pace and tell a nice union story.
Okay.
It was in the 50s, and my dad worked at a machine shop, and across from them was a foundry. And they each had unions, but they were different unions. And the only way you can get in there was one way. It was like an alcove where both places had to go in the same way. And the foundry went on strike, and my dad's shop, of course, they were union, so they couldn't cross the picket line. So they decided that they were not going to, you know, cross the picket line.
Right.
And so the guys that were on strike, they had strike pay to help them, and my dad's shop had nothing. And this was in the 50s when there was no credit cards or anything,
right,
and they didn't have much money.
Yeah.
And how we survived, I don't know. I remember getting, what do you call it, federal food.
Oh, yeah. I did. I remember
called?
That, too. Before my dad got a good union job, he was selling Rexairs and World Book Encyclopedias door-to-door, and we would go to the surplus food store on the weekends and get these five-pound bricks of American cheese and 20-pound bags of macaroni and eat macaroni and cheese all week. I remember that when I was five years old.
And that took a lot of guts with those guys, you know, because they all had families. Like my dad, he had three daughters, and I always remember that. I thought that was just so great of those guys, and the people in Wisconsin, when they started doing what they're doing, that's what it reminded me. That's why I brought that back, that story back, because those people are just wonderful. You know, the way they stuck up for themselves, and I just thought they were just, I just admire them so much, because you don't see that much nowadays, because, you know,
the unions have been wiped up.
They have weakened the unions so much.
Yeah, because of Taft-Hartley.
But I did want to mention that, did you watch Scarborough the other morning when he said the people in Wisconsin were recalling Walker out of vengeance?
No, I didn't, but,
I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, there's a lot
he
of nonsense.
To educate
that,
himself.
I'm with you. Darlene, thank you very much for the call. There's a lot of nonsense on television, especially. Anyway, Dolores in Portland. Hey, Dolores, thanks.
Hi, Tom.
What's
you
up?
Know, I was so glad that you had this guest on. I tell you, I am just irate at the thought of him. I'm so glad you guys exposed that to the world, because he is really a piece of work. Now, how is it that we want to give credibility to people like the tea baggers, who are full of racist, bigots, and greedy people who want to plunder and take over the country? How do they associate black people with slavers? I don't understand that. And that is what they are. And not only are they into enslaving people, not just black people, mind you, they are enslaving everybody, because they are taking over the country. They are stealing the country right from under us. And we have watched them do it little by little by little, and now they are out of control. And now for him to sit up there and say that any black people short of Clarence Thomas would consider joining them is just unthinkable.
Yeah.
I don't understand that you look at...
Except that he said at the end of that interview, he apparently we had the wrong picture. I didn't, you know, our...
Well, I don't care how it
but
was.
Go ahead. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Dolores.
And for him to equate all millionaires like the Koch brothers, can you imagine that?
Yeah, no, I was pretty surprised by it all. Dolores, thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So Newt has a new proposal, and Romney's going after Newt about something that Romney maybe doesn't want to step into. I got to tell you about this, and we'll pick up your calls right after that.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And if this... A lot of, there's a bunch of amazing things going on. Number one, Newt Gingrich wants to establish permanent colonies on the moon. Here he is.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my moon base.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was Dr. Evil. That was Austin Powers. Here's the actual Newt Gingrich.
By the end of my second term, we will have the first permanent base on the moon, and it will be American.
There you go. Now, at the... I would much rather see all the kids in America able to go to college for free. I mean, I'd love to see a base on the moon. I'd be fine, but... Newt, we got 50 million people living in poverty. You got unemployed people. You got people without insurance. You got one in five American children. You know, you've got one in 10 American children experiencing food insecurity. In other words, going to bed hungry at least one time during the year. We've got some serious problems in this country. You got companies like, you know, Apple producing this giant profit, you know, $13 million profit and 800,000 jobs gone from the United States. And that's not just to pick on Apple. I mean, as I said, they're playing by the game. They're playing the game by the rules, just like Mitt Romney is when he pays 13.9% income tax. And why is he not releasing last year's tax return? Well, because this year's tax return shows that he carried forward a loss from last year, which means probably last year on the millions that he made, he paid nothing. It's speculation, but probably. But I find it particularly interesting that the new Romney attack against Newt is that back in the 80s, he was picking fights with Reagan, and he was trash-talking Reagan. This was all over Drudge Report. It's all over the right-wing websites. You know, they're forming this phalanx now of, you know, we've got to take down Newt because he can't beat Obama, but Romney can. Romney's got Wall Street with him. Romney's got the big money guys with him. Newt doesn't. Newt's, you know, and they're probably right. So they're trying to stop. So the right wing is trying to stop Newt, and they're doing it by attacking him for not being with Reagan in the 80s. Well, guess what Romney was in the 80s? A Democrat. So isn't it ironic that Romney, or at least not a Republican, isn't it ironic that Romney is attacking Newt for not being with Reagan, when Romney himself, when he was running back in the 80s, was saying, I'm not here to support Ronald Reagan, or words to that effect? I just find it totally bizarre. By the way, Rand Paul said he was detained by the TSA. The TSA said, no, we didn't detain you. He said, oh, yes, you did. You forced me to stand in that box and told me I couldn't move. That's a detention. And they said, no, we never forced you. You know, well, the security footage is out. You can see it over at rawstory.com. Turns out Rand Paul was telling the truth. Surprise, surprise. Sean in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
I want to talk about hope, Tom. And on that subject, I wanted to give a little quote from, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest president this country has ever had, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Shortly before he died in April of 1945, he wrote a speech which he never had the chance to give. And in that speech, he said, the only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. Let us move forward with strong and active faith. And I think that the Democratic Party tries to do that a heck of a lot more than the Republican Party does, certainly more than the Tea Party does. A lot of fear-mongering. And the Democratic Party seems to have a message of hope, which is why I'm still a registered Democrat. I understand there's a lot of people who want to talk about doing away with the two-party system, but for right now, it's what we got.
Yeah.
And I think we need to go with the party that gives us a little more hope.
Well, I wouldn't just go with the party. I would infiltrate the party, take over the party, become the party, you know, run the party, you know, which is what the Tea Party did to the Republicans, by the way. I mean, there's a reason why John Boehner is starting to twitch a lot, because he's always looking around his back to see if Eric Cantor and his Tea Party buddies are about to shove that knife into his back. And that, you know, I think it's pretty extraordinary how the Tea Party took over the Republican Party. And they did it through this grassroots effort that, yes, you know, it was funded by multimillionaire lobbyists and billionaires and whatnot. But still, they did it through getting average people to show up as committee precinct people precinct committee persons in the Republican Party, and those are the people who determine who the primary candidates are going to be. And then they made sure that, okay, you're going to have a Republican primary, and there's going to be for a congressional seat, and there's going to be three people in that primary. All three of them are going to be Tea Partiers. So guess what? You're going to have a Tea Partier in that seat. And by taking over these local Republican committee precincts and ultimately local Republican, you know, areas, the Tea Party was able to get their guys in office. And progressives can do the same thing with the Democratic Party. So I'm with you, Sean, although I would take it a step further and I would just say, you know, no, we need to go whole hog. Bill in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? I'm the Ann Arbor cab driver, the Vietnam veteran.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to comment that I was out here this morning. They had close to 5,000 to 7,000 people that were waiting for tickets for the Obama speech tomorrow out here.
Wow.
He's going to be doing it, I believe, at U of M Stadium.
Uh-huh. So he can still pull in a crowd.
Oh, he sure can, especially around here. And it's amazing with as many people who seem to be backing the Republicans, and there are a lot of them here on campus. Surprisingly, he does draw a big crowd, and especially when you got 110,000 seats over at the U of M Stadium. That's a lot of friendly faces.
Yeah. Well, I hope he takes Rick Snyder on head to head. I realize he's running a national campaign and he may not do that, but boy, what Rick Snyder is doing, what Governor Snyder of Michigan is doing in Michigan is not getting anywhere near the publicity it should. Of, you know, putting these emergency managers that are making a couple $100,000 a year in charge of like Benton Harbor and parts of Detroit, and then they sell off the commons to their crony buddies, and I mean it is just.
I think people are starting to wake up to that here in Ann Arbor. I've been talking to a lot of the students, and a lot of them have been telling me pretty much that they are catching on to what's going on. And the funny thing was, when he was here during commencement a couple of years ago, I remember when he pulled into the stadium, after thanking everybody for inviting him to come down, he gave him the old, go blue! Of course, that brought a rounding cheer from the crowd. And
sure, at U of M, yeah.
He goes with the cheap cheers.
Yeah, there you go. Well, every politician does. I mean, you know, that's just natural. Bill, thanks a lot for the report. I appreciate the call. Jerry in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Oh, I'll tell you what, Tom. I've been talking to whoever interviews the caller. A thing that's been bugging me since 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in 1952, I was going to the University of Washington, and I went back and forth to Wisconsin. But anyway, I was riding to school. We were commuting with a grad student, and he had taken some poli-sci course. And this, I'm leading into this 1% thing.
Yeah.
Now, he was talking about, I don't know if he was a course on Marx or Engels or whatever it was, but he had a quote that he gave me, and it stuck in my mind for the last 60 years. And I'm hoping you can confirm it or point it out to where it might come from. This is having to do with deregulated or unregulated capitalism.
Right.
The seeds of capitalism will destroy itself as the wealth becomes accumulated in fewer hands.
Yeah.
That thing has hung with me for 60 years.
Yeah, I don't know who said it, but it's consistent with Karl Marx's analysis of capitalism and Das Kapital.
Well, I wonder if it came out of Das Kapital.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I don't know, but tragically it's the truth. As long as that word unregulated is in there, and
well,
there
right.
are
and that was the whole thing that he based it Marx. If it's Marx,
yeah.
And then this is where Reagan starts it off by jumping off those traffic controllers, you know, eating away
yep.
with the.
Yep.
And you've been talking about how the unions have been being less and less and less.
Oh no, Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor, and we have had that war pretty much continuously, with the exception of Robert Reich being labor secretary under Bill Clinton. I mean, we had one good labor secretary who really did a great job, and he's still, thank God, he's still around and he's still talking and he's doing some great work, but teaching out at the University of California at Berkeley.
Yeah.
But Jerry, I want to get another call in here in the minute I got before we got to wrap up this segment. So, James in Harlem, New York. Hey, James, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Fine.
I have more of a comment. You know, people talk about we have a two-party system, but in actuality, we just have one-party system. And those are the people who control the money, which are the bankers.
Yeah. And you can thank the Supreme Court for that.
It don't make a difference what president is going to be in there.
Well, it does make a difference around the edges, and the biggest edge that it makes a difference around is that the president gets to nominate the Supreme Court nominees. And if you had, if George W. Bush, if the Supreme Court had allowed the state Supreme Court ruling in Florida that the entire state had to be counted, if they had allowed that recount to continue, the state of Florida would have discovered that Al Gore won that election. This is what the New York Times reported a year later in November of 2001. And had, you know, Al Gore been president, then you wouldn't have had Sam Alito and John Roberts on the Supreme Court. And had you not had Sam Alito and John Roberts on the Supreme Court, you would not have had Citizens United. And so it does make a difference. It may not make as big a difference as both of us would like, but it does. There's a huge difference between Bush and Obama.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes, find out what's going on here in D.C. and around the world, and more of your calls 45 minutes past the hour.
Higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. Got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay. Yo, take your kids to the seashore, man.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you at Talk Radio News, brought to you by the new book Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Well, Ellen, welcome.
Mass Avenue Northeast, next to the Heritage Foundation.
Ellen?
Yes.
You are on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? Sorry, just dealing with something here. Okay, lots going on here. The president is off, and he just gave a speech to the UPS facility in Las Vegas. This is going to be a refueling station for liquefied natural gas. This is his whole clean energy fuel thing. And the White House yesterday evening had a conference call. They said that they're going to put strict rules on this issue of fracking. I don't know that that's going to be enough to keep the environmental community happy, but at least the White House is trying to make some rules on the issue of fracking.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to find out what's in those fracking chemicals. My prediction is you're going to discover that there's toxic waste that they used to have to pay to dispose of, and the way that they're disposing of it now is using it as a fracking chemical. But time will tell. I mean, we'll see.
Well, you know something? We always tried to find out what kind of dispersibles they were using to disperse the oil down in Mississippi. I have never been able to find it. We actually had a chemist on hand that was going to be willing to take a look at it, but no one could ever get it.
I mean, what's in that Corexit or whatever it was?
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's a secret, too, still.
As far as I know, it's a secret because we tried to get a hold of it. I even had a chemistry professor willing to analyze it for me.
Amazing.
Okay, there was a Senate vote this morning. The House is out of session. They are actually having a retreat up in on the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Interestingly enough, you and I were not invited, Tom, but Ed Schultz was to speak to the group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So, but they're having a retreat, and today the Senate voted 44 people, 44 senators decided to block a motion to increase the debt limit. 52 voted that they should continue it, basically, is how it worked. And they wanted to do a $1.2 trillion debt increase. Interestingly enough, two Democrats voted with Republicans. No surprises here. Joe Manchin running for re-election and Ben Nelson of Nebraska. Again, no surprises. Four Republicans actually voted, did not vote at all. They just sort of were absent.
Yeah. Okay.
Some other interesting things going out. Now, the defense budget is going to be coming out very, very shortly. Actually, the defense budget is going to be coming out in just about 5 minutes after I get off the phone with you. We have our reporter, Justin Duckham, there. And they're going to reduce the Army. This is no news because they've been talking about it, by 80,000 soldiers. That's eight brigades, about 10,000 per brigade. They want to say that they're going to increase the drones by apparently 30% in terms of drone usage. And, of course, a lot of people have some issues around that. 30% on drones. And then they want to grow the special forces up to 70,000 people, about another 7,000. in special forces, and what they're advertising, so to speak, is that it's going to kind of be like Somalia, where they want to be able to do these very strategic interventions. They also said they want to rebalance the forces is what their uses they're using. Now, it's interesting. I mean, you and I have our own issues about the military and how much money we spend. But when I talk to the Republicans this week, they're saying, how can, you know, we're not going to be a force that's going to be able to deal with any of these missions. We need to have troops on the ground. So, I mean, you know, this is going to be very, when the budget committees come to Congress, and, you know, they start as soon as the budget's released, about mid-February, usually it's the 6th, it's going to be, I think, the 13th or 14th this year. And then all of a sudden, all of those guys go all over the House side and the Senate side to talk about this, and you know the House Republicans are just going to take them apart, despite the fact that they voted that if the Debt Commission couldn't come up with this, that there was going to be automatic cuts to the budget. Well, now that there are these automatic cuts, they're complaining about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, a couple other interesting things. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dempsey, gave an interview today, and he gave the interview to the National Journal. He's very concerned about Israel. And what he's saying is, on two hands, he's saying, one hand, they're not going to take anything off the table with Iran. On the other hand, he's told Israel to sort of ramp it down in terms of trying to take out their nuclear facilities. As you know, Israel believes that Iran is going to have the ability to make a bomb very, very shortly. And he then said a conflict with Iran would be really destabilizing. He said it would be economically destabilizing as well as a security.
Did you see where Ahmadinejad came out today and said he's willing to re-engage in talks with the United States?
You know something very interesting about that. I was just going to talk about that. Our own Bob Ney got a letter, and I know I've talked to you about this before as a sort of a reminder, got a letter from the Iranian government saying that they were even willing to recognize Israel. And he sent the letter to Karl Rove, who was then in the White House, and then also to the State Department. Both of those have said, well, we never got the letter, even though there was absolutely acknowledgement. It was also sent to our U.S. ambassador in Switzerland from the Iranians. Well, I am totally convinced to this day the reason they went after Bob Ney is he was the only member of Congress that spoke Farsi, and he knew the Iranians were willing to negotiate.
Not just negotiate. They were willing to recognize Israel's
right
to existence and to recognize them as a country, which is a whole lot more than most of the Arab countries in that region were willing to do at that time. This was during the Bush administration.
This was during the Bush administration.
And then Bob Ney finds himself in the middle of the Jack Abrams scandal, but he's the only guy who goes to jail other than Jack.
That's
you know,
right.
Whereas it sure looks to me like Ralph Reed was doing a whole lot. Well, don't get me started.
I want to just give you a quick update on mixed economics and signals. Leading indicators improved. Durable goods increased, went up. However, jobless claims also went up.
Okay, great. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and brought to you by Self Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And that book, of course, by Ellen. We will be back with John Nichols from Madison, Wisconsin.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is absolutely incredible. The Bank of America is, you know, in Arizona, they're forcing them to renegotiate some of these loans that were fraudulent. And after they do the renegotiation, they file the forms with the state so that you can actually see them. You know, it's if you go down to the state house and dig them out or sue to see them. And this one borrower who defaulted on a $253,000 mortgage, the Bank of America flipped it and turned it into a 40-year 2% mortgage. And the borrower, and this is right from the document, quote, will remove and delete any online statements regarding this dispute, including without limitations, posting on Facebook, Twitter, and similar websites, and will not make any statements that defame, disparage, or in any way criticize the bank's reputation, practices, or conduct. I don't know if I should be laughing or crying. That's amazing. John Nichols with The Nation, thenation.com, the Washington correspondent for The Nation and a resident of the great state of Wisconsin. John, we've heard from several people in Wisconsin today in various parts of the state about what's going on and what happened last night, or was it the night before the State of the State address?
Last night.
And also that there's new felony charges coming up against a couple of Walker's aides, and that he's raising millions from oil barons in Texas and Wall Street banksters because of a loophole in Wisconsin law. Fill me in on all this stuff.
It's a roller coaster, mister. And let me just tell you that the best way to see this is that last night, Governor Scott Walker delivered his State of the State address. It's very much the equivalent of President Obama's State of the Union address. Highly publicized on statewide TV this year, especially because of all the controversy over labor rights, paid a great deal of attention. A lot of protesters showed up, also some Walker backers. Very intense moment. The governor hoped to use that appearance to pivot out of all the controversy of the past and really launch his campaign for re-election in the all but certain recall vote that will come sometime in the coming months. Instead, this morning, as he is touring the state, attempting to kind of get all the post-State of the State attention and glory, he gets hit with the most serious indictments related to his campaign finance and political ethics, political scandal controversy yet. And what's been issued, these are quite amazing things, Tom. A 57-page complaint has come out from the Milwaukee County District Attorney. Person has been running a 20-month investigation into Walker's pay-to-play politics. This complaint reveals that Governor Walker's closest aides set up a secret email system within his office when he served as Milwaukee County Executive. This is the office he held immediately before becoming governor.
So this is while he was running for governor.
It was right during his campaign. In 2010, this secret email system allowed taxpayer-paid aides to communicate directly with the Walker campaign about campaign fundraising, campaign finance issues, and policy issues, i.e., who gave us money, who wants what. More than 2,000.
That's what Randy Cunningham is in prison for.
You're starting to put the pieces together, sir. And more than 2,000 emails have been revealed, including the better part of 1,300 emails between Governor Walker's then Deputy Chief of Staff, a top county aide, and the person who was running the governor's campaign, who went on to become Governor Walker's Chief of Staff. Most interesting in all of this is the woman charged with multiple felonies, four felonies of abuse of a public office, and basically taking taxpayer funds to do it while doing political work, worked for Governor Walker's reelection campaign until a couple days ago. And so all of this is linked, you know, directly out of, this isn't some distant scandal from years ago. These are the key players who are literally right next to the governor. And this indictment or this complaint also reveals the linkages between the governor's current spokesman, Cullen Wehry, and this whole scandal. Wehry has requested and received immunity in the John Doe investigation.
So is he the one who turned?
No, we don't know that he's turned. We don't know exactly what he's saying or what he's doing.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that the person who is literally at the governor's side every day, right now, has taken immunity in a John Doe investigation that now reveals massive levels, and you're talking about thousands of emails, massive levels of what the Milwaukee County District Attorney believes to be felony actions related to
the governor. Pay to play, which is what we used to call bribery.
Yeah, well, I think we still do if we're speaking plain English.
There you go. Yeah, that's pretty mind boggling.
I'm telling you, Mister.
And yet, at the same time, you know, the headlines yesterday were that there's no Democrat in the state who can beat Governor Walker, even if he gets kicked out and he runs for reelection.
Well, you know, I always think of that as politics is covered very poorly by most people who call themselves political reporters.
Okay.
Because they tend to be much more interested in a horse race than they are in the actual dynamics of campaigns.
Sure.
What I'm going to suggest to you is the information that is coming out now, placed on top of all of the deep concern about the governor's actions with regard to labor rights and voting rights and other issues, creates a circumstance where I think that the Democrats who are in the race might well have a chance to beat him. I don't doubt that. But also that other people may well start to look at this race. This is really serious stuff, Tom, and it gets to kind of the heart of the sort of ethical and clean government issues that former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold made the center of his political service over 30 years. I'm not saying Feingold's going to get into this race.
No, I think he's going to try and take back his Senate seat, don't you?
No, he's not going to run for his Senate seat. He
really?
Said he will not run. Huh. And oh, he may, like, in 6 years from now. You're talking about the one.
Yeah.
It's possible. But what I'm saying is the nature of where things are going is going to create new pressures on former Senator Feingold to rethink whether to run for governor.
Right.
Because you really are talking about a level of scandal surrounding Scott Walker and his aides so intense that the 2012 recall campaign may not be purely about the labor issues that you and I talked about so much last year. It may end up being a campaign about, you know, whether to address what looks to be rampant lawlessness in and around state government.
Which raises a troubling concern, John, and that is that for the voters who are the occasional viewers of politics, or the occasional, you know, the toe in the water, the so-called independents, or basically I call them uninvolved, you know, the people who are all, they may not, you know, this story might end up getting spun as, okay, oh yeah, he was a corrupt governor, of course everybody's upset with him, he was corrupt, when in fact people were upset with him because of his policies. And
yeah,
those policies will get downplayed, the corruption will get played up, and people with similar policies like Rick Snyder and Rick Scott and Mitch Daniels,
yeah,
and others, you know, are going to get ignored.
Well, Tom, that's why we have you on the radio.
Okay.
Look, again,
and TV.
Country is covered horribly, by an awful lot of the people that we think should know how to do it better. It becomes the challenge for those of us who try to get serious about this game, to keep talking about all the elements that are in play, but we also have to recognize that no campaign is as simple as the pundits try to make it.
Sure.
We often see these counter streams going in. But what I can tell you right now is the streams going in, from this report today are very bad for Governor Walker.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly sounds that way. John Nichols, thenation.com. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you, as always. Amazing. Amazing. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's incredible. And what Bank of America is up to. But most important, what Mitch Daniels is doing in Indiana. I want to get back to this just very brief.
Recall! Recall! Keep on marching to the recall.
Those billionaires are gonna ball.
We keep marching to the recall.
See, this is what they need to be doing about Mitch Daniels in Indiana. I just don't get it. Why, you know, why the people of Indiana are not just, you know, blowing their stacks. And speaking of which, Jimmy in Lexington, Indiana on the line. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind?
Hey, what's going on?
What's up?
I live in Indiana. You were saying this should be national news. I agree. I live in Indiana and have to watch Kentucky news to see what's going on in Indianapolis.
Really? Why is that?
You tell me. I think that's the way they do it. The media does it around the border states, so nobody knows what's going on in their own state.
I did
get a survey card.
Uh-huh.
But the wording in it was manipulative, just like my local paper. Every now and then it'll have an article, and it's manipulative, too.
Right. Everything's got a right-wing spin to it. Everything's been,
yeah,
Foxified.
Yeah, that's how they're getting away with all this stuff, behind everybody's back.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely
like
right,
Mitch
Jim.
Daniels and Walker or Ken.
Yeah, yeah. Two peas in a pod, absolutely. Jimmy, thank you very much. Well said. And thanks for watching us there in Indiana. Robert in San Francisco. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got a new bumper sticker. Republicans 2012, race to the bottom.
That's perfect.
But on a more serious note, you know, it really doesn't matter how much we make here. We can't compete with China or Mexico or other countries. It's just impossible. You know, we can't work for 50 cents an hour or 20 cents an hour.
And that's true of most countries around the world, that most countries have ways of protecting their own domestic workforce. And it used to be everybody used tariffs. Now most everybody's using VAT taxes, which are effectively the same thing as tariffs when it comes to imports and exports. And we're doing neither. And therefore, you know, we have no rational trade policy. We have an irrational trade policy. And, you know, China stepped in and said, hey, this is cool. We'll take this. And I, you know, you can't criticize them for that. And it's not just China, by the way. Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Brazil, Mexico, there's Canada. I mean, there's no shortage of countries. Germany, I mean, Germany's exporting enormous amounts of stuff to the United States. There's no shortage of countries that actually protect themselves against American imports, but we have no protection against their imports. So they have the equivalent of a tariff on our, you know, when we try to export to them, but there's no equivalent on in the other direction. And it's nuts. It's we have no trade policy in the United States, and we haven't had a reasonable or rational trade policy in the United States since the Reagan administration.
Does prevailing wage can you still work for prevailing wage in different right to work for less states?
You're talking about the Davis-Bacon Act?
Yes.
I think the Davis-Bacon Act, you know, I don't know if it applies just to unionized workers or not. I don't think so. I think the Davis-Bacon Act says, what it says is that if the government is hiring, you know, people to do work, that they have to pay, even private contractors, they have to pay the prevailing wage. And I believe that it covers everybody, but I'm not an expert on the Davis-Bacon Act. I'm sorry, I can't tell you, Robert. But thank you very much for the call. And interesting. Mark in Breckenridge, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to find out if we could eliminate our debt to China if we give them a couple aircraft carriers and let them patrol the Persian Gulf and the rest of the world and just let them have it.
Well, they're building their own. This last century was the American Empire's century. The century before that was the British Empire's century. The next century, I believe, you know, this century, the 21st century, is going to end up being the Asian century, not just China, but, you know, all the Asian countries. And it's like whoever decides to step up to the plate, whoever takes advantage of you know, how things are going in there, and whoever plays it dumb. And we played it really dumb, you know, during Reaganomics and the whole, you know, Ross Perot was right. I mean, there's just no other way to say it, Mark. So, I you know, there you go. Joey in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening on Sirius. Hey, Joey, what's up?
What up, Tom? How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Joey. How about you?
Let me just let you know, me and my girlfriend Jennifer are big fans, and she's probably listening. So
well, thank
say
you.
Hi to her.
Okay.
That's a question. All right. You got the second best show on Sirius, so that's good.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, I'm a liberal who kind of wants to sit on my hands when it comes to voting for Obama. Mm-hmm. I know I don't have to go through the list with you of all the things he's let some liberals down on, but you know, Mike Malloy and stuff like that, you know, he says he's one of the ones that says don't go vote for Obama. So I kind of wanted to get your take on it. I mean, I definitely don't want a Republican in office. So I just wanted to get your take on it.
Well, that's your choice.
People like me.
And that's your choice. And just think about this. You know the kind of damage that's being done to America right now by the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court? I mean, it's fairly obvious to everybody. You know, Scott Walker going out and to Wall Street and coming back with $4.5 million and, you know, from a quick trip to New York. The incredible damage that's been done by the Supreme Court by John Roberts and Sam Alito being appointed by George W. Bush had, or for that matter, the incredible damage that was done by the Bush v. Gore decision, which I believe was unconstitutional and illegal. Imagine if the next president is Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich, and they get to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and they get to replace Kennedy on the Supreme Court, and two people who probably will retire within the next 5 years. Ginsburg almost certainly, and she's the most liberal member of the court. Can you imagine the kind of damage that court will start doing?
Yeah, I mean, that matters. See, that's the important stuff.
Obama has, he signed the Defense Authorization Act. I can give you a list of things that I don't like that he's done. But he's also done a lot of fairly positive and progressive things, and he's talking about a whole lot more. But it's almost like, it's not the lesser of two evils. It's like somebody who's...
I want him to fight more, Tom. I want him to fight against the Republicans. I want him to stand up and let people know that these guys are
he will,
the country.
He will do that, Joey, when he knows that we've got his back. Any politician will do that when they know that the people are with him. Politicians don't lead from behind. They get out in front because they know people have got their back. And so we need to be speaking up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the incredibly new vocabulary word, ugly. And your calls. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very ignominiously ugly. The good. Bill Gates. In an interview with the BBC, Gates was asked to respond to President Obama's call to increase taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Here's what he had to say.
Well, the United States has a huge budget deficit, so taxes are going to have to go up. And I certainly agree they should go up more on the rich than everyone else. That's just justice.
Of course, Mitt Romney has dismissed people like Gates, claiming that they are riddled with envy. However, Gates and other billionaires like Warren Buffett, who feel the same way, have far more money than Romney and view paying more taxes as doing their fair share to help the country and the economy. If Bill Gates and the League of Extraordinarily Rich Americans are ready and willing to pay their fair share of taxes, then capitalist vultures like Mitt Romney should be too. Well said, Bill. The bad. Sniper crosshairs in Missouri. 5 Democratic state senators in Missouri returned to work Tuesday only to find large orange crosshair stickers plastered all over their office nameplates. The crosshairs covered the doors of the only 4 Democratic women in the state Senate and the door of the Democratic minority leader. Some of the senators removed the stickers only to find larger ones covering the doors later in the day. In response, the Missouri Capitol Police have increased security around the Democratic offices and in the Capitol as a whole, but have no leads on the possible culprit. Republicans have routinely used crosshairs for political speech, most notably Sarah Palin. But we all figured the rhetoric would be toned down after the Gabby Giffords shooting last year. Tragically, that's not the case in Missouri. And the very, very ugly, Rick, don't Google my name, Santorum. President Obama discussed his plans to increase access to higher education in his State of the Union speech on Tuesday. In response to these plans, Santorum told CBS News on Wednesday that it's no wonder President Obama wants every kid to go to college. The indoctrination that occurs in American universities is one of the keys to the left holding and maintaining power in America. Right. When kids learn more about the world of science, they tend to vote for Democrats more. Maybe that says something about Santorum's Republican Party more than it says about the so-called indoctrination. By the way, I guess the only indoctrination Rick prefers is the kind that teaches kids that same-sex marriage eventually leads to man-on-dog marriages. That's very, very ugly. So very, very insane. Scott Walker heckled at the State of the State yesterday. John Nichols mentioned this at the beginning of the hour. I've got just a very short video clip here I want to play for you. Jim, if you got that thing? Okay, here it is.
Tonight, the state of our state. To do so, we need to remember where we were as a state prior to a year ago, what we've accomplished over the past year, and most importantly, where we are headed in the year to come. When I addressed you in this chamber last January, Wisconsin had suffered through 3 years of 150,000 of our fellow citizens.
And on it goes like this. You know, people kept interrupting him and kept getting dragged out, and outside they were chanting, against him. Desmond, by the way, here's the whole Bill Gates thing about on the BBC. It's a longer version of the clip, but Bill Gates was asked by the BBC, what do you think about this whole thing of Mitt Romney paying 15% taxes or whatever? You know, the whole thing about the debate about capital gains taxes and low taxes on billionaires.
Do you agree with President Obama in his State of the Union address that the Buffett rule needs to kick in, that people as wealthy as yourself should pay more tax?
Well, the United States has a huge budget deficit, so taxes are going to have to go up. And I certainly agree they should go up more on the rich than everyone else. That's just justice.
It's just justice. Is it a message that you think works with other people as wealthy as yourself? Or it's a small circle of friends, yourself, Warren Buffett, a few others?
Well, I hope we could solve that deficit problem with a sense of shared sacrifice, where everybody would feel like they're doing their part. And right now, you know, I don't feel like people like myself are paying as much as we should.
Now, contrast that with clip five, Jacob, here, Mitt Romney's wife. It's an unfortunate thing we had to release our tax returns.
I would like to let you know something about this guy that you might not know. You all know he's been successful in business. Unfortunately, that was made abundantly clear yesterday when our tax forms were released.
Yeah, unfortunately, everybody figured that out. Here's Mitt Romney saying, no, I didn't actually pay 13.9%. I actually, you know, because I gave away some money, that should be considered like taxes. And because he ties 10% to the Mormon Church, plus he gave money to other charities. And, and by the way, that money that he gets from Bain has already paid taxes on that. Now, somehow he thinks that means he paid taxes on it, which makes no sense to me at all. I mean, you know, if I take a paycheck from a company, the company got the money from somebody who bought the product with money that they had already paid taxes on. So should all pay be exempt from tax? But anyway, here's Mitt Romney trying to square that circle.
Then you only paid 13% of taxes, while most Americans paid much more than that. Is that fair?
Well, actually, I released 2 years of taxes, and I think the average is almost 15%. And then also, on top of that, I gave another more than 15% to charity. When you add it together with all the taxes and the charity, particularly in the last year, I think it reaches almost 40% that I gave back to the community. One of the reasons why we have a lower tax rate on capital gains is because capital gains are also being taxed at the corporate level. So as businesses earn profits, that's taxed at 35%. Then as they distribute those profits in dividends, that's taxed at 15% more. So all totaled, the tax rate is really closer to 45 or 50%.
But is it fair what you pay, 13%, while most pay much more than that?
Well, again, I go back to the point that the funds are being taxed twice at two different levels.
Right, right. So let's see. There's a kind of burger joint downstairs from your coffee shop, and I pay taxes on my income. In fact, I pay more taxes than Mitt Romney does. And I mean, who doesn't, right? So I take my post-tax income and I go down there to that coffee shop and I buy a cup of coffee. And then they take, now that's post-tax money. That's already been taxed, right? So then they take that money and they pay it to their employees. Should their employees not have to pay taxes on that because that's money's already been taxed? I mean, this is the kind of weird, bizarro, parallel universe logic that the conservatives are using constantly. I mean, I've had Steve Forbes on this program try to make this argument. It's just, I don't know. It's amazing. Anyhow, Ron in New London, Connecticut, you knew more about the Davis-Bacon Act than I did, so chime in. And thanks for listening on our iPhone app. What's up, Ron?
Yeah, not a problem. I am a union pipe fitter. I worked in the state of Connecticut, and about a year and a half ago, we were working on a new high school in eastern Connecticut. They brought in a non-union electric company, or electrical contractor, I should say. And I was talking to one of their workers one day, and with Davis-Bacon, what it does is they've got to pay the non-union guys have got to pay their employees the prevailing wage, whatever the prevailing wage of the state is. At the time, it was about $24 an hour.
Right.
But what they did to get that money back was if there was an electrician working on the job, they would charge him $2 an hour for the office help, $3 an hour for the tools, till they got him back down to his non-union wage.
You're kidding.
No. And these guys, there was like, I don't know, probably 15 or 20 of them. They sued the contractor. and the contractor went out of business before the lawsuit could be decided. So what had happened was the union, the electrical union came in and took all these guys in.
Yeah.
But that's the way, that's exactly how they do it, Tom.
That's amazing.
They come in, okay, we'll pay them the prevailing wage, but then what they do is they charge them $2 an hour for the office help. They charge them $3 an hour for renting the tools.
Yeah, it's like the old Tennessee Ernie Ford song, Oh My Soul to the Company Store, where they literally, back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, you would have company towns, basically, or communities that were around a business where the business owned the housing,
right,
and they charged people
right
rent. The business owned the store, and you had to buy your food from the
and
at the end of the week, you might end up actually owing the company money for the privilege of working for them, and that's amazing, Ron.
And I was listening to the cheap bag guy that you had on there, and I was laughing. It's the unions that have ruined the country. You know, I've got a friend of mine that's an extreme right winger, and even he's starting to come around. He said, "You know what happens if the union wage goes down?" I said, "What do you think is going to happen to your wage? Your
yeah.
wage is going to go down too.
Yep.
You know, your wages are going to go up if the union wage goes down." I said, "You don't understand.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
happening is they're trying to the companies want to make all the money and not let you make any of it.
That's right. And the CEOs want to take it. And you're right. It's a race to the bottom. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Well said, Mike in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today, man?
Great. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was just looking. Romney makes $57,000 a day.
Right.
Okay? And hypothetically, if we were to apply a 91% flat tax rate to that, he would still make $5,130 a day, or approximately $1.9 million a year, which would have been equivalent to, when I retired, 13 days of my pay, which I was making very good pay.
Right.
All I can say is thank God for the OWS, who make inequality one of their planks.
The Occupy Wall Street.
When platforms are presented at most of these, TV, the other TV people are going, oh, what are they demonstrating for? Well, it's one of their planks.
Yeah, okay? And in fact, you're pointing out a 91% tax rate. What most Americans don't know, and it's so weird. I mean, you look at even Wikipedia, and they only go back to Reagan's tax cut. It's like everything's been rewritten by the right wingers. And the fact of the matter is that during the Republican Eisenhower administration, Mitt Romney would have been paying a 91% income tax. And anyway, Mike, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the Republican Eisenhower administration is when Mitt Romney's dad was running American Motors, and he was offered a $300,000 bonus, and he turned it down. He said, give it to the workers.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Tim in Linville, Indiana. A lot of folks calling in from Indiana today. I guess my Mitch Daniels rant is working. What's up?
I heard the call, Tom. Yes. Had a little information about Mitch Daniels when he first got into office. He raided the unemployment coffers to help balance his budget.
Hmm.
And then more or less sold part of Interstate 69 that's being built to Australia, a billionaire down there, unnamed, of course. And I was sitting here thinking, while waiting for you to answer, I wonder if that is Rupert Murdoch.
No, he became a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, well, and that may be why Indiana is foxified, you know. I was just trying to put two and two together there.
Yeah, yeah. But foxified has got to become a new verb, you know, and that we got to get this in the dictionary because
Indiana is full of fox zombies. It's just so strange.
Fox zombies. There you go. The Fox so-called news channel. Tim, thank
right
you very much. Thanks a lot
for
calling from Linville, Indiana. John in Chicago. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I'm watching your show, and I wanted to get a point across. I know Senator Simons will be on tomorrow and might not be able to get through. I would like for you to ask him about the WEP, the windfall elimination provision.
Mm-hmm.
It affects us seniors. A lot of people don't understand. You got a municipal pension, and you worked enough in Social Security. Then they take about half of your Social Security right off the top, and then they tax you on that.
Okay. I don't know the answer to that question, John.
I wanted you to ask
Yeah, and I yeah, and I can't promise you I'll remember until tomorrow, but you know, just try and call in, and in fact, if you call just before the show starts, even you can get in line for to talk to Bernie when he's on. So, John, thanks a lot for the call. I'll do my best though. Chris in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to talk a little bit about jobs. I think the biggest problem regarding jobs right now is that no Republican, no Democrat, no politician in general is willing to talk about the inevitability of an essentially jobless economy in the not-too-distant future. In my mind, there are two reasons that available jobs will continue to decline. The first is technology. Technology has always killed more jobs than it creates. As a matter of fact, Marshall Brain, the guy who created the HowStuffWorks website, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, predicts by the year 2040, 2050, robots, computers will be doing as much as 50% of the work that humans currently do.
Sure.
There's a recent commercial by Cisco, actually, that showed a robotic assembly line arm fixing another robotic assembly line arm. So the things that humans would typically fix are even possibly going to be fixed by robots.
Yeah. Now, Chris, back in the 60s, this was being predicted. And the promise that was made to us, there was an article in Newsweek magazine about it. I dug it out a couple of weeks ago and did a rant on it. And because I remembered it from when I was a little kid, where they were all talking about the leisure society is coming.
Yeah.
That we're no longer going to have to work 40 hours a week, but because of all this automation and these robots, you know, it'll make it, you only have to work 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week. And the leisure society is coming. And the Jetsons, remember the old Jetsons cartoon? And George Jetson went to work, and he just sat there with his feet up on the desk all day long, and he complained that Mr. Spacely was a slave driver because he made him push that button three times a day. But what had happened was we actually did get the leisure society. We actually have seen a dramatic increase in productivity, and more people would have jobs if we had gone to a 30-hour work week instead of a 40-hour work week and increased our pay. But instead, the CEO class, the investor class, the Mitt Romney class, skimmed that money off the top. The top 1% have seen their wages go up 275%. And you know, since Reagan came into office, and the average working person, not much at all.
Well, the second thing I was going to mention, actually, was that our current economy is based on the artificial stimulation of consumption via planned perceived obsolescence, status symbols, etc. So it's really pushing the limits of what our natural resources can provide.
You're right.
Any sustainable economic system would have to significantly reduce consumption for the sake of consumption. In the long term, this would lead to a reduction in the number of available jobs, although in the short term, one could argue that creating a more sustainable, greener economy could create jobs like building and installing solar panels, windmills.
Well, recycling itself has become a major industry,
and it might become
a much larger industry. So,
but the key in the reduce, reuse, recycle is reduce.
I don't totally disagree with you. The key to the whole thing is saying, okay, can we have an economy where people actually work less and make more, and in fact, if you go to, for example, Sweden, what you will see is the answer is yes. A couple gets 18 months of paternity and maternity leave, and they can split it up any way they want, paid, you know, required. Yeah. And they can take it any time they want during the first 10 years of the life of their child. Because they got it that, you know, rather than letting the benefits of automation go just to the CEOs and investors, they're going to drive those benefits down to the workers. And that's
one other possible solution is actually a basic income guarantee, and there's actually a group called U.S. Big that advocates that because of the problem.
You know who was the first guy to recommend a basic minimum wage, that every person in America should have a basic income, whether they're able to work or not? You know who the first American to recommend that was?
I'm not sure, no.
Thomas Paine, in a book called Agrarian Justice that he wrote in the 1790s. And he laid out that proposal. And Thomas Paine, he proposed that. He proposed Social Security. He proposed basically Medicare and single-payer health care for everybody. And he said everybody at birth should the government should establish a small fund in that person and which would grow over time as an investment. And that person should have an income throughout their life, whether they're working or not. And there should be an absolute minimum income, a minimum standard of living. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And for watching us there in Virginia. Up to tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here for our weekly national town hall meeting with the guy that I think of as America's senator. We'll be, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.